News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello, everybody. This is Jay Shapiro again. Thanks for listening. There are a number of topics that I want to touch upon. A lot of the information is what I like to call under the radar, because these items do not get the big headlines, but they really paint a picture of what life is like here in the Holy Land and what's happening in the Jewish world and the outside world in general. I listen to local radio and I watch local television. I read the local newspapers and I try to choose those items that have meaning to people outside the country. I don't think, for example, that a car accident or a house robbery in an Israeli town would be of interest, but the cooperation between an Israeli academic institution and one in the United States says something about the state of research here in Israel. On the other hand, there is one general topic that I'm going to touch upon this time. It's the topic of the movement to boycott Israel by academics in the United States, and the fact that many campuses, even in places like New York, have become unpleasant and even in some cases dangerous for Jewish students. This says something not only about anti-Semitism, but also about the decline of academia in the United States. Jews have been called the miners' canaries of society. Before the invention of sophisticated equipment, miners would carry canaries in their underground working areas because canaries are more sensitive to certain noxious fumes than humans. So if a canary died in a mine, it was a warning to the miners to get out. And if Jews are not safe in academia, it means that something pernicious is happening that will spread and become worse. So BDS is a noxious fume that's threatening society, and it appears to be starting to spread in academia, the place where tomorrow's leaders are being educated. So essentially, the BDS movement against Israel is a warning that America may be in trouble. I'll spend a little time on this today. Thanks for listening. I'll be right back.
Always challenging the status quo. Hello, I'm Rod Bryant on Beyond the Matrix here at IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. I want to encourage you to listen each week, every Wednesday at the same time, for an amazing show that will challenge you, inform you, and inspire news, views, and wisdom for the nations. Here on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. Don't forget, Beyond the Matrix every week, Wednesday, here on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. On this segment of the program, I want to say a few words about a new location for pretty virulent anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism has been around as long as there have been Jews. It's been called the measles of humanity. It's been called a lethal obsession. And after the Second World War, it was calm or quieted down for a while, particularly in the West. Meantime, it grew in the Arab muscle world, where hardcore anti-Semitism systematically defaming Israel and defaming the Jews was widely and officially propagated. There was an intensity, and there is an intensity, of the culture of hatred that currently permeates books, magazines, newspapers, sermons, the internet, television, and radio in the Middle East. All of this on a scale unprecedented since the heyday of Nazi Germany. Indeed, the demonic images of Jews presently circulating in much of the Islamic world are sufficiently radical in tone and content to constitute a new warrant for genocide. They combine the devastating effect of the blood libel of medieval Christian Europe with Nazi conspiracy theories about the Jewish drive for world domination, and there is a dehumanizing Islamic attitude toward the Jews as calling things like sons of apes and donkeys. We have to deal with that. However, there is a new locale for anti-Semitism, the one perhaps would not have expected, but it is here and it is real. I'm talking about university campuses in the United States. I want to cite two examples, both having to do with the University of Michigan, because I think these examples are not extreme, and they point to what's happening in the universities. The first example was several weeks ago when a professor at the University of Michigan rescinded his offer to write a letter of recommendation for a student who wished to study in Israel. I'm not going to mention his name, but he was a lecturer in the university's American Culture Department, and he's explained his decision not to recommend the student by saying the following: many university departments have pledged an academic boycott against Israel in support of Palestinians living in Palestine. This boycott includes writing letters of recommendation for students planning to study in Israel. For reasons of these politics, I must rescind my offer to write your letter. Unquote. This is what this professor said and wrote. Now, this is wrong, obviously wrong. Perhaps the student's motivation for studying in Israel is exploring the diplomatic complexities of the region. Maybe the students of fervent Zionists is looking to strengthen their ties to the land of Israel by studying here. Or perhaps even a vocal critic of the state and its policies and its very existence. In any case, she would be welcome here. Interestingly enough, in Israel, Arab enrollment in universities here in Israel has grown by almost 79% over the past 7 years. Millions of taxpayer dollars here in Israel are dedicated to raising that number even higher. Now, the student for whom this professor refused a letter of recommendation clearly performed well enough in the American Culture course to secure a positive testament to their academic capabilities. This professor stated in his email that he'd be happy to go through with his offer to write a letter of recommendation for any other purpose. But because of this professor's political qualms with the state of Israel, maybe that those of his entire department, he reneged on his offer. Now, this is not an expression of this professor's constitutionally protected right to free speech. Instead, it is a failure to perform duties that a professor has to his students as a university professor in a free society. If this professor is only interested in vouching for the academic credentials of students who embrace his precise geopolitical outlook, he's not qualified to work at a public institution of higher learning. This professor is absolutely entitled to despise the state of Israel. He's entitled to teach his courses at the University of Michigan with this worldview in mind. Some professors already do. He's entitled to label Israel racist, genocidal, evil, or whatever he wishes to call it without fear of termination from his public employer. But however, when he allows his partisan aversions to the state of Israel prevent him from handing his students the praise he openly acknowledges they've earned, this is an offense that get them kicked out of the university. They're entirely worthy of the outrage they seem to have stirred up on social media. The same outrage would be in order if a professor refused to sign a letter attesting to their students' academic credentials because they sought to study abroad in China, Russia, Iran, or any other, even an American university that has a loathsome record of human rights. Now, none of these countries, China, Russia, Iran, any of these are pretty abysmal regimes. They never seem to trigger the radically and racially charged boycott of hullabaloo that Israel, a Western-allied liberal democracy, regularly finds itself at the center of on college campuses in the United States. Even in the city of New York, the Israeli ambassador's, I'm sorry, the Israeli consul in New York, his daughter goes to Columbia University, and she's being attacked as an Israeli. This callous and unhesitating fashion in which academics, professors, deliver their discrimination is a testament how deeply entrenched anti-Israel bigotry is within academia, particularly in the United States. And by the way, Diaspora Affairs Minister Naftali Bennett publicly scolded the University of Michigan because of another incident that happened here. A lecturer presented a lecture at a Penny Stamm Speaker Series. It's a school of art and design, and he displayed a slide presenting Hitler and Netanyahu side by side with the words guilty of genocide. Bennett, our minister, diaspora affairs minister, and education minister, sent a letter to the president of the university and said what happened was deeply offensive and it's an act of anti-Semitism. And he further wrote, aside from the offense caused to the people of Israel and to Jews around the world, he wrote, I would sincerely hope that as head of this important academic institution would appreciate the severe detriment to the well-being of the students of allowing such hatred and racism onto your campus, even sanctioned in a mandatory lecture. So our education minister said, furthermore, I therefore write to condemn in the strongest terms the incident as reported and call on you to clarify urgently in both action and words that, as is said last year, racism has no place at the University of Michigan. Now, the time has come, I think, for the heads of the universities where this BDS is taking strong effect. They have to take a strong stand against what's clearly become a trend of vitriolic hatred against the Jewish state on the campuses. That's what's happening in the United States. So, as a matter of fact, a Jewish student from New York requested to get a reference for a teaching assistant where he applied to Tel Aviv University. But he was told that he would have to pledge and to boycott Israeli institutions as a way of showing solidarity with the Palestinians, and therefore he does not get a recommendation unless he could make such a declaration. Now, I'm a graduate. I personally am a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania, and I was probably, and I'm talking 60 years ago. I was, I think, the first student who walked around on the campus wearing a skull cap, a yarmulke. I remember once I was walking across the campus with two friends of mine who weren't Jewish, and a Jewish student came over and said to me, you forgot to take off your yarmulke. And I turned around and I said to him, pretend it's a turban and it wouldn't bother you. Nobody would take a Sikh from India studying university in the United States and tell him to take off his turban. University of Pennsylvania, by the way, has one of the biggest Hillel houses and the campuses in the United States. There are tens of thousands of Jewish students in the universities in the United States, and now they have to hide their skull caps, even hide the fact that they're Jewish because of this BDS and this really anti-Semitic thrust which is now taking place on university campuses. couple of years ago, we didn't think much about the things that are pretty much not heard about because they weren't so vitriolic and they didn't rise to the level of the faculty members. But this is a new phenomenon in the United States, and it does not bode well, both for the United States itself, as well for the academic institutions in the United States. This is something I never thought I would have to talk about, but it's something real. Antisemitism takes all kind of forms, but now it's in academia, and that is a threat to academia itself. I'll be back after the break.
Hi everyone, this is Andrea Simintow from Jerusalem inviting you to drop everything and join me on my show, Pull Up a Chair. We'll visit this week's quirky stories, meet fabulous guests, and discover my Israel. Together we'll laugh, shout, and explain the topics that make us say, hey, we've got to talk about that. So get comfortable and pull up a chair with me, Andrea Simintow, every Thursday on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. You know, there is an old Jewish joke about how Jews seem to relate everything to Jewishness. The standard joke is that a teacher asked her class to write an article or an essay about elephants, and the only little Jewish boy in the classroom wrote an article called The Elephant and the Jewish Problem. Jews seem to see that somehow they're related to everything that's going on in the world. Now, the reason I bring this up is because I saw an article that was published during the Kavanaugh trial before it was the Senate made its vote. It was during the highlight of the trial, which was taking place for about 2 weeks. And this article, I'm not going to mention the name of the author because I don't think it's important, but it relates to the elephant and the Jewish problem. The name of the article is Christine Blasey Ford and the Women of the Bible. Christine Blasey Ford, of course, is the woman who accused Kavanaugh of rape 30 years ago. And in this article, this woman writes that women, and I'm pretty much quoting it, women telling intimate truths in the public sphere, women raising their voices demand they be treated fairly, women challenging the leadership of the land to listen compassionately to their stories. We find this in the Bible. And, of course, this person relates this to these latest allegations of sexual misconduct against Judge Brett Kavanaugh. However, she writes, in truth, women have been speaking up for a long time, for at least millennia. You look in the Bible. There are characters in the Bible who speak up. The heroines of the stories are the women who dare to challenge discrimination and call out abuse. But equally important are the men in power who listen to the women with humility, wisdom, and commitment to justice. And this writer goes on to say, the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee might do well to study their Bible a little more deeply. Take, for example, the story of the five daughters of Tzelofchad. We know very little about the character himself, but we do know is that after he dies and he had no sons, his five daughters appear in court to argue for a woman's right to inherit the land. So, still, it's a demand by five women, sisters, in the ancient world, and they take their complaint to the highest court in the land. The judge is Moses, and Moses has humility and wisdom, consider the merits of their case, and in fact, he rules in their favor. Another example of a woman in the Bible is Hannah in the book of Samuel, and she doesn't have any children. She goes to the temple during the high holidays, and the high priest kicks her out because he's assuming she's drunk because she sees her lips are moving. What she's actually doing is praying. So she tells the high priest why she is praying like that. She corrects the highest spiritual authority of her time, the high priest, explaining he was simply transported by her prayer. So the high priest apologizes and he acknowledges that Hannah is in the right and her prayer will be granted. That's where the prophet, she became pregnant with the prophet Samuel. And a third example, one I think that the most Jewish listeners are familiar with, has to do with the Megillah that we read on Purim. The story is Queen Vashti. It's read today, according to this woman, as a cautionary tale for leaders who fail to listen to women. Vashti's husband, King Ahasuerus, is so desperate for the admiration of his subjects that he throws a party for all the men in the kingdom at the end of the week of this, actually it was half a year, of this raucous party. He commands his queen to appear in her royal crown to display her beauty, and she refuses. So his advisors say to him, well, you better do something about it, otherwise other women in the in the kingdom will see this as an example that women won't have to listen to their husbands anymore. So there's a question, did he kick her out or did he chop her head off? That's immaterial. So, and then he gets a new wife, Esther, who's the heroine of the Bible, and she saves the Jewish people. So Vashti and Esther and Hannah and the daughters of Telefchad are really important biblical feature characters. Now, what this writer is now saying that in our time, quoting now, in our time, Christine Blasey Ford, Deborah Ramirez, and most recently Julie Swetnick take their place among those heroines who made the wrenching decision to speak out, risking everything for the sake of truth and justice. To the men and women who hold the future of the Supreme Court in their hands, this woman writes, I offer these stories as proof that there is an ancient precedent for the courage we required of you at this moment. Will you follow the example of Moses and the high priest, those powerful ones, courageous enough to truly listen? Or will you be like the king, unable to see the humanity of those standing before you? These stories are ancient. They make it clear that the imperative to listen carefully to those with less power is not some modern trend. It is a fundamental human challenge, one every generation's leaders will be called to meet. Perhaps the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee have risen to power only as of such a time as this. I pray that they meet the challenge. That's the end of the quote. This woman, this was written, of course, before the final decision was made. But it's interesting that it turns out that, for example, Julie Swetnick, it turned out she was apparently a liar. Kristen Brazy Ford couldn't remember exactly who did what to whom and so forth. But somehow this woman, who is apparently some form of biblical scholar, falls back to the tradition of the old joke. I guess you can call it Judge Kavanaugh and the Jewish problem. So it's very interesting. I pass this on to the listeners just to show how everything can be arranged or perhaps twisted in order to meet an agenda. So listening to these people who turn out not to be quite telling the truth, listen to these women essentially is important if you're and I believe it is, by the way. I believe, of course, justice should be done. I wouldn't belittle that in any way, shape, or form. But to use a political fight in the United States had nothing to do with a judge's ability, and then that people look upon it as a women's rights or a Jewish problem, then I think something is entirely out of whack. Some things stand by themselves, have to be judged on their own virtues, and you don't have to bring in the Bible in order to justify your own position vis-a-vis gender rights or things of that nature. But it seems that today this is the kind of thing that's being done. People relate. That's part of what is known as, I think the standard word for it is intersectionality, which holds that the various forms of oppression, racism, sexism, classism, and homophobia and so forth, they constitute an intersecting section of oppression. So according to this worldview, a transcendent white male heterosexual power structure keeps down marginalized groups, and it unites oppressed groups whether they have anything to do with each other or not. According to this theory, all these oppressed people should get together, strengthening them against the dominant power structure. So that's what you have. And here, this intersectionality is being used to influence the senators, or, you know, it's not going to influence. They didn't read this article, but it's going to make people understand that intersectionality seems to cover the whole thing. So I pass this on to the listeners just to show how I think things are getting a little bit out of whack vis-a-vis how they relate various subjects. And since I mentioned that the Kavanaugh hearings, I thought I'd say one final word on this segment about the Democratic Party. Almost two-thirds of the Democratic members of Congress, 112 representatives of the House of Representatives, and 34 senators sent a letter in appeal to U.S. President Donald Trump and Secretary Pompeo to reverse the decision to end vital United States contributions to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency. They claim that the administration's decision will exacerbate the already dire humanitarian crisis in Gaza, where 1 million people, half the population, depend on UNRWA for food assistance. Now, the truth of the matter is that UNRWA runs 278 schools in Gaza, which are attended by some 300,000 students. But a lot of the UNRWA money is used for terrorists and for buying and hiding munitions, things of that nature. And so it turns out that the some of the UNRWA staff was withdrawn for safety reasons, and they're being harassed and prevented from carrying out their duties. And it turns out that the Democratic Party, not the Republicans, just the Democrats, want to see to it that UNRWA, which is really a bad group, I've spoken about them before and I'll speak about them again, the Democrats are supporting them. So the J Street, which is a left-wing Jewish group, claimed that the U.S. administration's reckless actions can and must be reversed. In other words, they're saying they have to keep supporting that group that supports terrorism. I'll be back after the break.
Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
Shalom from the heartland of Israel. This is David Ha'ivri. Join me every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Israel time, 10 o'clock Eastern, for A Hebrew in the Heartland on Israel News Talk Radio. Hear the news and views from the heartland of Israel every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Israel time. Be there.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hi, you're back with Jay Shapiro. This part of the program, which I do fairly often now because I've gotten positive responses from the listeners, I call this Under the Radar. These are various items which are not related to each other, but they give a picture of what's happening in Israel And it's the kind of thing you don't really follow every day. Generally, when you read about Israel, no matter where you are in the world, you see the big items. Years ago, I worked at Israel Aircraft Corporation, and one of the fellows who I worked with in the same office was from Helsinki, Finland. And he went back home to Helsinki for a vacation, and he came back and he said, you know, it's an absolutely unbelievable phenomenon. I live here in Israel, and I never, ever see anything in the newspapers about what's happening in Helsinki or in Finland. But I was back for 2 weeks in Helsinki, and all I read every day on the first, second, third, maximum fourth page in the newspaper was about things that are happening in Israel. But unfortunately, or fortunately, I guess, the things that happen in Israel that get the big headlines are the big items, our relationship with our neighbors, our relationship with the European Union, so forth. So what I like to do in this section of the program, which I do fairly often, especially now that I've gotten a lot of positive response, is to give a picture of what's happening in Israel that's under the headlines, under the radar, but they really say something. Now, the first thing I want to talk about is the fact that, you know, when I came to Israel, somebody made a remark which stayed in my mind. He said, you know, Israel has no natural resources, absolutely none. In fact, the one lake that Israel has in near Tiberias, the Lake of Galilee, it only flows in one direction down through the Jordan River, and it empties into the Dead Sea. And now the Dead Sea, because of the heat and so forth and the lack of water flow, the Dead Sea is drying up, which is really a problem. But we have no natural resources. Therefore, the only natural resource which we can rely upon is the people who live here. And that is why one of the good things about Aliyah, about the number of people who come to Israel, is that they bring talent. Now, it's true that Israel brings in people from all around the world, some of who are really in the status of refugees, like the Jews who come here from Ethiopia. On the other hand, you have the big influx of Jews we had during the 90s from the Soviet Union, many of whom were trained engineers, doctors, and so forth, professionals. So they added to that natural resource, which is the people of Israel. Having said that, I want to share with the listeners information about a new program that's being launched at Tel Aviv University. It's a program to integrate students from a range of academic backgrounds into Israel's high-tech system. The program is called Sciences to High Tech, and it's in the Faculty of Engineering at Tel Aviv University. And what it will do is it will enable undergraduate students to combine engineering studies with all dual disciplinary programs, including the humanities and the social sciences. During their studies, students will develop a strong mathematical background and focus on computing and information systems. Courses that are going to be studied there include data science, artificial intelligence, machine learning, encryption, and information security. The program will conclude with an internship at some high-tech company. The program is also open to graduates who receive a further undergraduate degree upon completion of these new studies. Now, this has all been approved by the Council for Higher Education in Israel, and it's already received the backing of high-tech industry leaders and the Education Minister, Naftali Bennett. And it represents a significant attraction more and more students to scientific professions. The state of Israel needs to increase the number of talented young individuals who opt to go to the world of high tech and continue to lead the innovation, creativity, and breakthroughs that change reality. Emphasizing the potential benefits of combining technological expertise with other fields of studies, the president of the university said that there have been studies conducted by Google that revealed the eight most important qualities of the company's successful employees. The eight qualities include what's a new word called STEM, S-T-E-M, which stands for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, And this is of least importance, it turns out. The top seven qualities, and I found this fascinating, what's called soft skills. These skills include the ability to get along with people, the ability to encourage others to produce, the ability to take chances, to start new businesses. Now, Israel's been ranked eighth globally, and it's the only non-American institution of the top 10 countries that produce, listen to this number, 640 entrepreneurs, 531 companies that have raised $7.91 billion in venture capital funding since 2006, 12 years. So little Israel, as I said, has only one resource. The resource is the people of Israel, and we are taking an advantage of it, particularly at the academic level in universities, by supporting those programs that allow, that encourage and allow potential entrepreneurs to come up with ideas, even if the money that they get to do these comes from outside the country. And a lot of Israeli companies now are on the New York Stock Exchange and the European Stock Exchange. So this one natural resource is the intelligence of the people, and we've been able to take advantage of it. On a very different subject, I want to say something about the reversal of American policy toward Israel under President Trump. At the end of last week, President Trump won a tremendous victory in having Kavanaugh chosen by the Senate to be a Supreme Court justice. And the United States president has clearly aligned himself with Israel. He has taken a stand against a decades-long policy of not recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and he's authorized the move of the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And he says, and speaking at the U.N., he said, America's policy of principled realism means we will not be held hostage to old dogmas, discredited ideologies, and so-called experts who have been proven wrong over the years. Trump has also defunded the U.N. Agency on Palestinian Refugees. To some UN member nations that do rally behind the Palestinians, it's a politically correct way of hating Israel and assisting those who seek her obliteration, all these nations in the UN. But the American president has decided to really do something very different. He has decreased funding to the Palestinian Authority because of the manner in which the Palestinian Authority responded to the recognition of Jerusalem. The president is apparently in favor of reducing foreign aid for those countries which openly belittle the United States and her allies while accepting American dollars. So he made good on his campaign pledge to move the capital to Jerusalem. To move the embassy to Jerusalem. At the latest UN session a couple of weeks ago, our prime minister met with U.S. Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, the White House Chief of Staff, and several advisors to the president, including his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and Jason Greenblatt. And at these meetings, Trump assured our prime minister the U.S. was 100% behind Israel. And of course, Netanyahu, our prime minister, responded by commending the president for having changed history by acknowledging Jerusalem as Israel's capital. So he also applauded Trump and what he called Trump's robust defense of Israel's right to defense, and for having the American representative to the UN speak up for Israel, championing Israel, something few others are doing, and which the United States has not done for years. So it's a very interesting situation. It's hard for us in Israel here to believe that things seem to be happening so well. Things are going so well. But this is the world that we live in. By the way, I think it's just as an aside, I think it's an interesting thing that we have a prime minister who speaks English so well and expresses himself so well. And that speaks, you know, that's good for Israel, that we have a prime minister who can represent us. By the way, our prime minister's speech at the UN several weeks ago, in which he revealed what's happening secretly in Lebanon because of Iran and hiding nuclear stuff and all kind of things like that, speaks very well for Israel's secret service. And I think it wakes the world up to the fact that Israel's a small country, but we have a lot of capabilities. As I said at the beginning of this section, we're a small country with no natural resources except the people. And not only are people... Our people are good at starting businesses, being entrepreneurs, but they also apparently are pretty good at spying on others to make sure that we stay safe. Having said that, take care of yourselves until next time. Jay Shapiro signing off.
Israel News Talk Radio's chat room. Just click the orange button at the top of the IsraelNewsTalkRadio.home page, log in as yourself or an anonymous guest, and join in on the fun. You'll meet other listeners from all over the world who listen to Israel News Talk Radio, and you can make new friends. Israel News Talk Radio's chat room. It's the closest you can get to being in the studio with us.
We love listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Where can you get the inside news on Israel? At Israel News Talk Radio, we're dedicated to sharing Israel's inside story with the world by providing our listeners with news on Israeli politics, current affairs, and Israeli Jewish culture. The Israel News Talk Radio homepage also provides you, the listener, with useful information at your fingertips, with scrolling news headlines, weather, currency exchange, Shabbat candlelighting times, and so much more. Our radio programming is always accessible and on demand. We operate absolutely free of charge for everyone, everywhere. If you love what we do, partner with us now by becoming an Israel News Talk Radio supporter. With your support, you'll be inscribed on our Israel News Talk Radio Wall of Fame. There's nothing like us in the world. Be part of something great. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.